And I think often, as we are like so distracted world with the devices and technology, people drawn into story, people drawn into just human, genuine experience and connection. So, as innovative it sounds like, it actually comes down to it. I just eager to connect more, which seems more rare in this time. And the performer talk about the emotion. Performer will try to talk about that musical feeling and visuals. Sometimes when I bring the visuals on the projector, it's all connected so that I can help audience to experience better. So I believe the power of storytelling. I believe a power of simply you and me, we're gonna share this music in a very meaningful way.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide, with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Ji-Yoon Kim is a very special concert pianist who's opened meaningful connections to new audiences through her innovative concerts, albums, podcast, and now her book, Whenever You're Ready. You'll learn how she sold out her Carnegie Hall debut recital without knowing one person in New York, without an agent or winning a major competition. She's generously shared three tracks from some of her albums that punctuate this episode, and please head over to her website, which is linked in the description. I was so honored when Ji-Yoon agreed to be part of the series, because I knew her wisdom, personal story, and her music making would resonate strongly with you. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast. And I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com, where you can sign up for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks for upcoming guests. Like her book, Ji-Yoon's valuable perspectives and insights are helpful to both musicians and listeners. This is an episode full of inspiring and heartwarming stories.
Hi, Ji-Yoon. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I was just saying to you before we started recording that I did discover you mostly through your book, which I'll hold up whenever you're ready, How to Compose the Life of Your Dreams, which is a beautiful book. And I know you wrote it not just for fellow musicians, but for everyone really, to have tools to help them in their lives.
Yes, I did. I mean, the title, Whenever You're Ready, is actually came from, I was waiting for my Carnegie Hall debut concert, and often there's a manager, stage manager, holding the door to the stage, and this particular one was like completely hidden, and then manager holding the door and asking for my cue and say, whenever you're ready. And that very moment, a lot of my life comes through my mind, and still make that decision within, and I'm gonna walk to the stage. And I realized that all of these things that I do in life to prepare to being on stage is so related to, of course, fellow musicians, but how to live life. So I wanted to make a book, perhaps just like a friend. You know, sometimes you hear all this life wisdoms that you know, gurus and whatnot, but your friends say, you know, these things really helped me. Then all of a sudden you listen to that. And I wanted to my book to be very friendly and gentle and just share what I learned. And I hopefully, as a reader, you get a sense of inspiration. And hopefully whenever you are ready to embark, whatever the journey that might be, this book might give you courage to make that first step into unknown.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed reading it, and I was rereading it again to prepare for today, and it really resonated with me because I think we have a lot of the same outlook and habits, and I kept thinking, yes, you know, I just really was things that I use. Now, I actually didn't know about your podcast before I read the book, and then in the book you point us to some podcast episodes. Mm-hmm. So Journey Through Classical Piano is very well loved around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it actually started during pandemic. I think as you could resonate that with that too, that often we as a freelance musician, we sometimes get interviewed by podcasts like this, or you know, or in the past there was radio, news, you know, all of that. And then I was interviewed one of the podcasts in the past, and one day I thought, what if I make my own podcast and talk whatever I want to talk about with the world? And that was a very daunting idea at that time. But at the same time, kind of that curiosity of, oh, that would be really fun. And that was my like fun project. And then I just set it aside because, you know, we have so many hours a day. And I was just keep focusing on what I was doing. And then that thought just keep coming back to me. Like, oh, what kind of mic? You know, I was, my free time, I realized myself researching more about podcasts. And then finally, I gave myself a permission to go for it. And, you know, with the first episode, it was a mic. Sound quality was really bad, but I thought to ask myself, will I have fun? Yes. Will I help someone in the process? I think yes. Then why not? So my mission as a pianist is to bridge this beauty of classical music to people who may not have access. And I, as a classical musician, it's just such a saddening when people say classical music is dying, classical music is difficult, and you know, so I wanted to kind of create some home, like you know, invite people to my living room, and I experiment with many of my friends that have no idea what classical music is, and they're like, I don't know what, you know, but I'll play one piece for you. You know, this piece is about heartache. I really feel this composer, you know, I don't know what he was going through, but I feel that happy yet sadness and that complexity. And I talk about my emotion related to it and I play. And they're like, oh my gosh, June, what is this about? I never thought that piece of classical music would touch my heart in such a way that I never experienced. And then I thought, you know, podcasts is such a great medium because it's intimate. Mm-hmm. I'm actually introvert. I practice to be extrovert, to be a, become a musician and on stage, everything. But podcast fits me in a way that I just talk to you like a friend. And I, at this point, it's mostly 10 to 15 minutes of episode and one piece of music. Most of the 90% of the music is actually performed by me, which makes it very more intimate in such a way that I talk about this piece and struggles as a pianist and the thoughts behind it and maybe some historical findings that I help me to understand the piece, just like a living room performance. And I think it's moving forward, I will use other people's performance, but when I get to use my own recording, that's the most intimate experience I found.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to play a track from your first recording, 10 More Minutes. And I was going to ask you about this Brahms intermezzo because I grew up hearing my brother practice it. He was a serious pianist at the time. And it was just the sound of going to sleep for a certain time was him staying up late practicing this. And your performance is really beautiful. So what does this piece mean to you?
You know, I thought at first when I encountered this piece and I was struck by just the beauty. And then as I get into the piece more, and that discover my difficult lifetime experience in the past, sometimes often bittersweet moment of my life and a lot of heartache, whether that is a loss of someone or, you know, it's related to most of the lost. But yet at the end, I'm here, I'm alive, I'm fully content at this moment. And so that juxtaposition of complexity is always hit me hard. And whenever I perform, there's often I become teary-eyed, no matter how many times I perform this piece. And I often feel like I can play this piece in the middle of the program. So I often program at the end because it's hard to recover from it if I really perform it in such a way that I want to perform this piece. So 10 More Minutes album is actually a collection of encores. So that this piece came like a best friend to me, just because it was with me for, has been with me for a long time. And no matter how many times I perform, how many times I practice, how many times I listen to again with someone else performing, it reminds me why I am a classical musician, and the beauty of just a piece of music can do to our soul and to me, and those deep sense of connection emotionally with the composer and ultimately with myself. And hopefully that connection resonate with listener. And a lot of listeners would, audiences say that I thought of my past, my mom who passed away, or whatever their experience. This piece brings another memory or feelings to their life. And I know when the piece of music is that powerful, I carry along for myself and for others.
You're about to hear the Brahms Intermezzo, Opus 118, Number 2, from Ji-Yoon Kim's album, 10 More Minutes. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and your music as well. Now, I don't always like to start with people's childhood, but there are elements that you described in your book that I think are really interesting to bring people's attention to. So you grew up in South Korea, and even the way you started is different to what a lot of us are used to in, you know, North America, where a kid would go to a lesson once a week. So it was multiple times a week. You were 4 years old. Can you describe for people what that was like, the process?
Yeah, I think that actually my book starts with a scene where 4 years old Ji-yoon walking in the alleyway of countryside of Korea with a backpack with full of, you know, piano music and going my way about to go to Piano Institute, which was a daily thing except Saturday and Sunday. And my parents were both business, so they didn't really was like micromanage my life. Even as a 4 years old, I just went, I knew I had to go to Piano Institute on my own. So, you know, I remember that's maybe just 3 or 4 blocks, but that was definitely a daily journey. And I stopped by this grocery store or this little you know, snack vendor that called sell tteokbokki, which is like a little Korean snack with a rice cake and things. And I was thinking, oh, should I have a snack on the way or not? You know, I'm just thinking about it. And then I went to the Piano Institute every single day, and that I took it very seriously, just like a, you know, serious businesswoman going to some work done or something. And so when I'm thinking back on it, and now I live in America, seeing other you know, kids in 4 years old going to an institute by yourself, and feels foreign, feels impossible, and I realize how different that was that time. And I don't think it is same, unfortunately, in Korea. It's, you know, safety issue, a lot of, you know, difference that changed since 1984. But I'm so glad that I learned independence such a young age, that every musician at some point have to learn that the habit of consistency. And I just, my environment made me into that setting from the beginning. And without that structure, I still managed to create it on my own even now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was interviewed recently about this podcast, and they were asking what all my guests had in common as musicians, because people play so much, many different types of music, fulfill different roles in our industry. But I felt like everyone has persistence. You just keep doing it, no matter how hard it is, no matter when you start or what you're doing.
I agree.
And you went to this competitive arts high school, also pretty different than what I was shocked by the public, you know, rankings. That was just...
Yeah, you know, now I'm thinking back, how cruel that is. And... but it was so natural, because that's just how it's done. And I didn't think much about it, but looking back on it, yes, every piano exam, once a semester, the end of, you know, like 4 months, every 4 months we had a piano exam, which was open curtain or closed curtain. Then the ranking of all of the, you know, you divided violinist or pianist, and it's not like mixed it either. So you know where your standing is on the pianist ranking, you know. But there were a lot of piano major, I remember, at least 100. Thinking about it, like 100 people majoring in high school, in art high school, it's crazy. But we saw the ranking very crudely afterwards. And, you know, but first three, top three, we always someone we could expect, like, you know, technically so clean, like there's no question, like, oh yeah, so and so number one again, oh, so and so number three, all right, you know. So every that was very cruel, but that was the society, a lot of a competition. And I think that competition is still there, and, you know, that I realize is the competition is everywhere, whether it's within yourself and with others, and often in when you try to compete with music, it's very toxic environment, which I wanted to drive away from, but I actually lived in that competition, competitive world for a long time.
Yeah. And in terms of those 100 pianists that you're in school with, you write about that in the book, what that maybe they didn't pursue music as a career.
Yeah, I know, including myself, 3 out of the 100 that are doing something with piano currently.
Yeah. This comes up with various guests. I think there's an element of burnout, especially from a young age.
Yeah, I think people don't realize in order to become a classical musician, like you're talking violinist or pianist, and it doesn't matter the instrument, you often start 4 or 5, and you know, you think it only Mozart started when he was 3 or something, and everyone else just started in the high school, middle school. No, we all started when we were like 4, and you know, a lot of people, by the time they got into college, they've been already playing like 14 years of their life. And then the unfortunate part is that your journey didn't even get started yet. And then, you know, often we pursue higher degree and 10 years afterwards that we still, you know, you didn't even start it yet. Then you're in the competition pool, or then you're audition pool. And then, you know, you feel like, why am I doing this? And do I even enjoy it? And I think that the burnout is almost like natural result of doing one thing for such a long time. And if you do that, you have to find a way to refresh yourself or some balance. Otherwise, it's like doom. You're doomed to have it. It's more of how you gonna deal with it. And you better equip yourself rather than, I'm never going to burn out. Because everybody will, if you think that you're going to start something from years of 4 and then, you know, 40 and 50 and 60. And it's a marathon. And I think a lot of people like, oh, at some point, once I make it to, I don't know what the definition might be, once I win this competition, once I win this audition for an orchestra, or once I get the position, I'll be fine. But then they burn out. Then they realize, oh, all life I pursue, is this what I wanted? You know? So I think more than any other field, our musicians have to be awake and keep asking questions. And not that fundamental question that do I love music, because I know we fundamentally love that. That's why we're here. But what an aspect of it that you enjoy? And is this a performing? Is this a teaching? Is there both? Is that what aspect that you will refresh in yourself? Is that to stop yourself from serious burnout? Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned teaching. You're an educator, but I found it interesting and understandable that you got your doctorate from Indiana University. I did go there, by the way, for my master's, so I...
Yeah,
some familiarity with it. And then you decided to pursue another master's in pedagogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think... First of all, everybody thought that I was so crazy after doctorate in Indiana, which was really rigorous program, one of the rigorous program, which you had to prepare 7 or 8 different repertoire. I mean, the recitals you have to do that not included in your repertoire list when you auditioned. So, which meant that like a series of 5 or 6, 7 years of higher degree in the master's and doctorate, I mean. And then afterwards, I realized that, I finally understood that I don't know enough. But the one thing I learned from the doctorate degree was that I know how to find it. Maybe the methodology that if I have a curious about something and I know how to find it and I know what is the right path, whether that in performance practice. So that was really tremendous lesson for me. But then afterwards, I realized My teacher at Indiana University doesn't know how to teach 4 years old. Mm-hmm. That really bothered me. And she can teach like any high level performer that you think it is flawless, that she will make it better. Beethoven sonatas, Chopin, doesn't matter. But then bringing first step into the intermediate, that was like big mystery to me. And I think I'm actually an educator at heart. I like to digest pieces for even audience and just create educator as a bridge. And the fact that I have no idea about how to bring the beginner, doesn't matter even if it's adult beginner, to just first Bach piece or something, was like so much of curiosity hole in my life. And you know what? I'm going to go back to piano pedagogy master's degree. And just to, you know, that satisfy my hunger. And then when I did that piano pedagogy degree, and I realized everything I learned in the, even from my 4 years old to doctorate degree, all my life as a musician made sense. Now everything like in the right organized box. It's hard to explain in words, but now I knew how to digest. And if I can teach 5 years old to this very concept, that means I understood and I can explain. That means, if you can teach any concept to the child, that means you really simplifying. You know, the simplicity is the high level of teaching. And I really strive for it and made me humble again. And okay, I did all of this higher education, but now make it simple to general audience, to the students, to whoever I meet. And I don't know better, but this very thing I want to talk about. But this actually came from a lot of research and a lot of education, but I wanted to make it simple.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
How do you change how you teach with different personalities of your students, different learning styles?
Well, obviously that is part of the education degree, that you start from the learning style and you understand what is my learning style too. So that's something that go back into. I was already I'm an innate communicator, one-to-one setting. So I know what this person, you know, empathy, or try to think for their perspective. And if I can sense that person is not getting it, and I try to another way, this way, that way. And so I think it is really related to communication skill, to vary the medium. And if it's a visual learner, I don't want to only give a visual learning tools. I use it a lot, but yet I want to give some other way so that this person is also expand their learning styles too. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, this is the theory that I learned, modality of the people's learning styles different, but that doesn't mean that we need to adapt our style only to that person. But then just understand the theory, the basics of it. But then I see it, okay, this person's actually lacking this way of education. So I want to just plug in a little bit more different way of explain or conversation. And a lot of it, I think it is just listening their body cues, listening to their life. You know, I often really surprised that when students are not able to accept what I'm giving, may not be anything related to their modality of how they learn, but the struggles in their mind or things that are bothering them, or so it can be life issue. So I have a lot of adult students too, so I often ask, did you sleep well? Are you eating well? Are you moving well? I'm just covering the basics first. And then I stepping forward, like, is there anything that, you know, difficult to your life right now, you know, can be piano related or not, you know, and I open a little bit of a channel to for them to open up. And it is a conversation. I always find it is a piano therapy, you know, because music is therapeutic. But then they may share some of struggles, if they may not. But once that they can be able to let it go of whatever the troubles of they have, then they make music better, because they actually be honest with this, with themselves and the transparency of it. And I think it is the same with kids too, and young students that may struggle with this tremendous pressure of school and other society and things. And I wanted to be there to listen to them and make a music as a healing process. Like, you know, this is not a test. We don't do music just because to be a more skilled pianist, more skilled violinist. We use music to share, to get deepen your relationship with yourself, and to get connect with the people that maybe passed away, or this music and the composer, and ultimately to connect, whatever that could be. So then, you know, all any of the modality that I use works. Mm-hmm. In that open foundation.
Yeah. And in terms of the way you've, you know, your career has blossomed as a performer, but supporting yourself also through teaching, in contrasting mm-hmm. to had you taken a position in a university, you'd be involved with their, you know, bureaucratic stuff, you know, teaching maybe higher level students. Do you ever think about that, like, or to speak with friends who have those kinds of jobs?
I think as a doctorate, you know, graduator with double degree with piano pedagogy, I, at some point of my life, I thought, you know, nobody can compete in terms of credentials with what I have. If they only think that, you know, in order to be a professor in university, you need a doctorate, you know, preferably good university, like Indiana University, you know, and in my mind, like, I'm so qualified. I mean, in fact, I'm overqualified. But then I realized that doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. The university position is like God-given. It has to come from somewhere else. It's not like you want it and you can get it. It involves so many different layers to it. Maybe there's some politics involved. Maybe there's some debt work. You might have to start somewhere in the city that you don't want to live for a long time, and the letter up. And, you know, I had no idea. And maybe sometimes the one recommendation from your teacher at, you know, in the university, that recommendation get you there. Just no questions asked. Doesn't matter. I mean, as you know, the musical world has been going through a lot of changes, but in the old times, there's not really one method works. And in my mind, I was diligently doing everything like that, maybe, but I actually didn't think that I will become professor, but I thought part of it, that's my option. And I just pursue my curiosity, but then now I have this degree, so why not? You know, that's professor sounded great. But then in the midst of it, I have friends that in a professor position in a university, and I realize in a university position, as shiny as it looked from outside, it's a lot of administration work, mm-hmm. a lot of repetition, a lot of just basic instruction, and then 4 years later, you start over. Mm-hmm. And it's not a long-term thing, but it's a lot of emails and meetings, and then you are becoming a little soldier for the bigger organization, which is university. So that the bigger organization want you to do X, Y, and Z in order for the mission or whatever the organization wants. Mm-hmm. But maybe that may not in line with what you want to do in your life. And I realized a lot of them, my friends are agonized with lack of time, but then responsibility, that because they feel they are tenure and they have to do X, Y, Z, and they don't want to do it. You know, those positions, maybe an Indiana university, those professors only teach certain hours and they can just perform and do nothing in emails, or they don't have to do anything. It's like a fantasy, and it's 0.000001, and that is even disappearing.
Yeah.
So I had a reality check and wake-up call when my position that I thought I would get, it didn't come through. And I realized, you know what? I don't think I would like to enjoy being professor, the work involved with it. I love teaching, but not everything attached to it. Mm-hmm. And then what I liked was the name, maybe the privilege it looks like, it sounded, and also the security. But then I have to question everything again. What is the security? If I am working at some place and mentally so stressed, is that secure? Is that secure enough? For me, it wasn't secure because it was not fun. And so I, you know, for some people, it's a perfect fit. But for me, I had to revisit. And even if I have all these degrees that maybe qualify for the job, but me as a person doesn't fit for the position. I have to create my own position for myself so that I can do all of those things that I'm interested in doing.
Mm-hmm. So if we could talk about your innovative concerts, because many people listening won't know that you do things very differently. Maybe we could talk about your Carnegie Hall debut and how that worked.
Yeah, I think we have to kind of go back in tracks. It's just because we just talked about I'm giving up the idea of professorship. Mm-hmm. And that's when I decided, you know, no adjunct, no part-time, no teaching one course or whatever, actually cut off. Just say no more. And then that was actually very difficult for some reason. I always taught, you know, course or two in the hope of whatever. But then I decided, you know, no, Jiyun, no, you're not gonna move somewhere that you don't want to go, you know? So then I turned, okay, what I want to do as a pianist is to obviously to share my music, but actually connect with the audience in such a way that it's people that don't know classical music or know classical music, in going to a concert, it's not like just a nice evening or just thing, but they are really passionate about the music as much as I am, and I wanted to open that door for them. And then first thing I came to my mind was to create an album, which is a dream for many of musicians to make your own album. But then the Sony didn't call me, you know, Deutsche Grammophon didn't call me. And then what? And a lot of people that they have their mystery of how one create an album, right? And then I realized, what if I just record an album? I'm going to make my own label. But then still there's question remained. How much does it cost? What is the concept? And so I thought, you know what? What does Sony makes album? What studio do they use? What photographer do they use? How do they do it? You know, I just need to come up with a concept, and then I need a funding to create it, and the level of Sony would make. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, you know, I have a solid concept, which is, you know, I shared the 10 more minutes. It's not 10 years more, but it's 10 more minutes. It's a very humble wish, something longing for the experience, whatever that experience give you bliss. And for me, it's encore. And the concert is over. Everybody wishes, let's do one more, you know, that communal wish. So I wanted to capture that longing feeling into the album. So that was a $30,000 that come up with that funding. And to make asking for donation video itself for 3 minutes cost $8,000. And I thought, okay, I will include that. And that's the numbers, such a high $30,000 for the CD production. It's included that just 3 minutes of video making was, hi everyone, this is my idea and I would like you to be part of it, that kind of. And then I had to practice the same sentence over again, that I have this project, I want you to be part of it and I need you to support. That was like not a big deal in my mind, but it was so big deal to actually talk to my friends or, you know, family and or even strangers. Like, I felt like so small to ask for money. And that humbling experience was like, you know, it's okay for you to say no, but I felt so guilty. Maybe I made them feel bad. But then there was a $10 coming, $100 here, $1,000, sometimes more. There are people started to react and with message attached, like, Jiyun, I love your music, go for it. I love the concept, great. I can't wait for the album. You know, every dollar donated had a love letter attached to it. And then I felt like, oh my gosh, this is my project, I thought. But it became everybody's project. And everybody who are part of it became their baby too. And then they become lifelong enthusiastic fan. And I was so surprised to discover this mechanism. How come you pay money, but then you are invested in, you become fan? And like, what is this, like, just something odd about this, you know? But then I invited them into my playground, and I realized, you know, I am also part of this project. In the big picture of this music making, I'm contributing, it's not me, but I am, as artist, I am creating something for people and I'm just doing my part of it. And then, so this funding was successfully funded, and then the next one was the Carnegie. And you know, everybody would say at least once or twice, if you're a musician, you be hearing someone saying, when are you going to play Carnegie, you know? And I heard that too, more than a couple times. And in my mind, it, you know, playing Carnegie, it felt like impossible. And but then one of my fans who contributed to 10 more minutes went to Michiko Uchida's concert in Carnegie and bought this postcard that it is a picture of Carnegie, and after the concert, and she asked Michiko Uchida, and can you write why not for the postcard? And she said, why not? And then, yes, please write it, why not? And then this person gave me that postcard to me, and I look at the postcard of Carnegie and say, why not? And I laughed. But then that night, I couldn't sleep, because actually for the first time, I asked myself, why not? Why not? And so I called Carnegie booking office next morning on the 9 o'clock in New York time. And, you know, someone's, get the phone like after one ring, just like a New Yorker. And so I said, hi, I'm a classical pianist. My name is Jiyun Kim. I'm just wondering, how do I play there? Silence. And I was thinking like, oh my gosh, I hope she doesn't say, just go and practice. But then she told me, next 5 minutes or so, long list of what you need. You need this form, this, that, and then you need a presenter, and then we need to verify, da 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 da. Whatever that was, like a long list. And I listen. One year and the other, the school was away because it was too much information. But then after I hang up, I realized there's a sense of light is turning on inside of me, thinking, ooh, playing Carnegie Hall, it's not a fantasy. It's a step-by-step method. If you follow this, whatever that is, I'll be playing. It's a just actionable thing. So I followed the action, and I found the presenter who believe in what I do. And from that phone call, like 2.5 years later, all of the people who donate this project, a lot of state, Indiana, California, flew to be in my Carnegie Hall debut concert. And it was sold out concert without knowing a single person in New York. And I walked to the stage and said, welcome to my dream. And this particular concert, as usual, microphone is on the stage. There's no program given at the beginning, because I'm going to explain to you, don't you worry, don't you worry. But when you walk out after the concert, you will be given a program. And there's no intermission. This is me and the music. You're going to take this journey with me. This journey of, I thought through every single possible way, what I'm going to say to you, what story I'm going to share, what program, what kind of emotions I'm imagining for you to take. Mm-hmm. I'm a tour guide, and I'm going to finish this. So as even encore, how I want you to live was planned. It's such a, like, a, in a way, it's like a theater in a way, you know, everything was in a very much thought through. And a lot of, there's some people who come to Carnegie Hall didn't know me, and they were like, why there is a microphone? Is this gonna sing? there's no program. What's wrong with this classical concert, you know? And so I tried to break the rules that if that's interfering me to connect to the audience. That's the concept of my concert. No matter what I do, I question one more time. I don't question the content, which is the music. I don't actually do the new age music. I'm playing very core classical music. But then I question, do I really need to go to the backstage and come back right out? Mm-hmm. That, is it necessary? For whom? Do I need it? Or does it need it for the audience? And I realize I may need it, but audience don't need it. So then I didn't go to the backstage. Mm-hmm. Just for that second, I don't need it either. And the talking part, as much as simple as just talking to the audience, I think through, if I maybe start with a 10 sentence, what I want to tell the audience, but then at the end, I might say 4 sentences. It's like a poetic. Mm-hmm. I have to practice what I'm going to say, you know, same way if I would perform. And I think often as we are like so distracted world with the devices and technology, people drawn into story, people are drawn into just human, genuine experience and connection. So as innovative it sounds like, it actually comes down to it. I just eager to connect more, which seems more rare in this time. And the performer talk about the emotion. Performer try to talk about that musical feeling and visuals. Sometimes when I bring the visuals on the projector, it's all connected so that I can help, you know, audience to experience better. So I believe the power of storytelling. I believe a power of simply you and me, we're going to share this music in a very meaningful way. There's no pretentious, there's no no background music needed because you don't need it. And when I tried to go from that perspective, everybody said, like, you're doing something so different. Like, really? Why so? What is so different about it? But maybe it is different just because where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Now you're going to hear Nikolai Kapustin's Concert Etude, Opus 40, Number 6, Pastoral, from Ji-Yoon Kim's album Shium.
I certainly hope I can go to one of your live concerts, but people can check out your YouTube channel. You have excerpts of some of your performances, and I think your podcast gives us a taste, although it's not multimedia the same way. Your recent project, Shium, you did an interesting tour with 17 different concerts.
Yeah, I did. That was an adventure for sure. So this offer came about is they ask, you either do all 17 in 1 month or no, nothing. Because it's routed such a way that it works just one artist go through all these little towns. And I was thinking, ooh, that sounds like those rock band in the bus and, you know, going to town to town, which is not really glamorous. But then I was curious. To go to the corner of America, and also who I become after going through the 17 concerts. What kind of musician I would become? What kind of person that I would become? I was curious for that, so I said, yes, bring it on, let's do it. And I have to say, this particular tour was one of the hardest and one of the most rewarding concert tour I've done. And I hired my close friend to be a tech manager, so because there's the projector, it matches with my piece. So there's a lot of multimedia stuff that I can't not train someone to do it. And not alone that between the cities, sometimes you have to drive 7 to 8 hours, and that's only, you know, a day back-to-back concert or something, and I could not do everything myself. I have to be a performer at some point. So I did that, and I didn't count how many concerts left. That was like the being now as on steroid, because I could not do, okay, now I did 5. Ooh, now 12 more to go. I could not be in that mindset at all. Otherwise, I would crumble into the pieces. I feel like I wanna quit everything. I wanna go home. And so I just be in the new city with a curiosity mindset. Like, oh, this city, oh, this piano. Interesting piano. Everything comes with a different challenge, different environment, different audience. And when I came to but one thing for sure I realized is that audience, those cities that may not have luxury of having concerts every week, Uchida playing, or, you know, like Kissin playing or orchestra, these are the town that this live performance is a treat, because it happens maybe once, you know, once of 3 months or once of 5 months. This solo piano might be once a year. So for them, they're more in tuned in the mindset of old timer, where there's a candlelight at night, they cozy up and want to connect with the real person, you know? So I connect with them, and the way I present concert, it touched them in a way that they didn't expect. And a lot of people said, I thought I came to entertainment, which is this concert or show. But then they said, this was a life-changing experience for me to connect. I don't know what you did, but I'm different now, an hour and a half later. And I don't think I did that. I think music did it. But I facilitated such a way that it made it possible for them. And I truly believe the way I did it made them curious about classical music, made them wanting to go more of classical music, and perhaps maybe turn on, you know, radio, NPR or something, you know, because one experience was such a positive experience of connection. They want to do more. Mm-hmm. And that was so connected to with my mission. And then the last 17 concert, before I play encore, I finally told the audience and say, you know, I have been in this tour for 17 concerts tour. And they were like very surprised. And today was number 17. And people were like really surprised to hear that, because they realized that I was a part of that tour, and they didn't realize this is the number 17 I finished. And that very moment, I was so surprised, because unexpected emotion came to me, and I was started to cry. And I didn't expect that at all. I was just sharing, you know, that this was number 17. But then all of a sudden, the sense of I did it, and this is number 17, how grateful, how amazing this was, how difficult it was worth it too. And so many emotions came about. And I was like, whoa, I still have an encore to play. And I told them, like, I think I made it, and I'm so grateful, and I will play the encore. And I play actually Brahms intermezzo at that time. And I was literally trying not to drop my tears on the keyboard. But then my partner was videotaping and taking photos, and he saw more than a half of audience was bawling too with me crying. And that was such an experience for everyone. And I will cherish that. And when I move forward in my life, whenever challenges, when in doubt, lean forward and trust that you will come out stronger and better.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this album, this concert project, you played La Pluie Collante by Debussy.
Mm.
It's very beautiful. Could we include that track or part of it in this episode?
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm in love with Debussy. Anything Debussy I love. I think a Debussy girl. I think his music making makes me a painter and free with the color of the music. And one of the favorite thing I do is going to Museum of Modern Art in New York, and there's fifth floor, I forget, but there's a Monet section, and there's a whole wall of water lilies, and I sit down, and I didn't realize he took this painting for 20 years from beginning to the end, and I'm experiencing it, his 20 years of struggle, doubts, life, thoughts, all of it. And I could feel it. And then his thing is, as all of other impressionist painters, it's evoke the image, evoke the sense of being there without doing every little details is expressed. And I think that whenever I play Debussy, I become a painter and go wherever that music brings to. And often there's a piece that calls pagodas that I go to Korea when I go up to mountains every morning to get water for the day with my grandma and play badmintons, and I hear gong sound in the Buddhist temple. I smell the pine trees, I feel the fogs, and somehow Debussy, you know, knows the sensation of Asia too, and all of it feels home for me. And Debussy allows me to be more creative, allow to seeking more colors, and have fun in the process.
This next musical selection is Debussy's La Pluie Collante from Ji-Hoon Kim's album Chium.
Thank you.
In one of your YouTubes about that tour we were just talking about, you were talking with one of your friends about, you know, playing on all the different pianos. You don't know what you're going to expect. And he was saying that you just bring out the best. It's like your attitude going in is, let's see what you can give me. I forget exactly the quote, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting because pianists have this very unique challenge, mm-hmm. which is you can't bring your own piano. And that challenge, it's sometimes a good thing, because what if you have bad instrument, you know? So it's a fair game. But at the same time, like every other, you know, musicians would agree, the instrument, it's not a thing, but living organism. And they speak to you. It's a living thing. I literally talk to my piano and sense it. Little changes, like maybe treble side today, it's a little more tingy, but maybe some humidity, or, you know, I sense it. I talk to them, and I don't name my instrument, but I literally take as a person that who has temperaments, mm-hmm. you know, personality and different moods. So whenever I go to a concert, it's very rare that I mean, there's maybe two or three times in my whole entire career that the piano is just perfect shape, that there's nothing I can complain about. Otherwise, the pianos, even if it's a 9-foot Steinway, you know, shiny instrument that everybody's rave about, they do have underlying health conditions. Mm-hmm. But when you go to these little towns, when you play in this gym that they bring little, you know, a grand piano, you in my mind I'm thinking, oh no, what is pianos, you know? But even then, doesn't matter what kind of piano is in front of me, if it's a Carnegie Hall or some, you know, little rundown hall in the upright, that I take it just like a person, believe in this instrument, like, okay, let's have a conversation. I know you can do much more than you think you could. So let's see what you can do. And I go, oh, I see you're a little bit of a freaky here. And sometimes like, nice, you have this such a nice voice in the bass. I'll use that. You know, there immediately we do have a strength as a pianist that you can recognize a weakness and strength. Mm-hmm. And certain pieces accentuate that weakness more or strength more. So then often I struggle with a certain piece. I need so much more power. And this piece, this piano doesn't give, but then give a lot of clarity, mm-hmm. which is great. So I compliment the piano as it is and wanting more color, more. You can do a little more. But then I constantly have to adjust with my ear, with my fingers, to make the best out of it. Oftentimes, the range of piano is, let's say, it's really narrow. Then I don't even get to the level 10 until I absolutely need it. Mm-hmm. Well, I stay in 7 for a long, long time, even though I know I can go 10, just for the effect of the final piece or something. Mm-hmm. So I have to adjust every single aspect of my music making for this piano. And the result is that people adjust it. People adjust their ears too. So I believe that if I ask for more for the piano, in a, like a person, and positivity, and talking like a conversation, more than you think, the piano responds so much more positively. And afterwards, I always thank the piano, I'm like, good job, you made it. And then I get the comment from the audience, like, I never knew this piano can do that, you know? But on the side note, I make a list of things that this particular organization technician, and when your leisurely time, please, you know, do X, Y, and Z, because I also realize a lot of pianists, because they come and go, they don't really care about this particular piano and they don't really give a proper feedback other than fix it now or, you know, be very temperamental about it. And my approach is that piano technician only have an hour, which is the only time for tuning. They cannot do the voicing, they cannot do the regulation, all of other things that I actually would like this piano to go. But I will tell the piano technician, maybe there's some notes that is really, really critical, I will say. Otherwise, I make a note and send them to them afterwards, which is just a, you know, thank you note. And it's not about me, but it's about the health condition of this particular piano and the community, you know?
Okay, interesting. Now, you paired each piece of music with a photo from Alan T. Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So I Googled him. I'm not sure if I found the right guy. Did he write a book?
Yeah, he did. Okay. He did. Yeah. So he's actually a friend of mine who is 90 years old. Very interesting life. And I don't know he would call himself a photographer, but he is a photographer. And 30 years ago or 40 years ago, he was more active with the film, black and white film photography. And then one time, you know, like 2 years ago, when I was doing this new project, Shiem, I wanted to have paired with visuals. But I was really having a hard time because I actually hired a photographer, create an image that I'm thinking. And then it wasn't it. Mm-hmm. Whatever he did was like, oh, no, that's not it. It's not it. And then, you know, one time at a lunch, Alan just did not know about this project. He just brought this boxes of black and white films. Like, you know, I'm just tired of it. Can you just get rid of it? Like, okay, what is it? You know, this little tiny square thing. And I was looking at it in the sun, like, oh. And then I was like, in my creative mind click, like, oh, this is the Scarlatti right here. This is Debussy right here. And then he was like, what are you doing? Can I use this film and like do whatever you wish? And, you know, can I just use it? Like, I do whatever I want and I could go for it. Otherwise, it's in my closet. Like, oh my gosh. And from then on, I searched for thousands of his black and white films. And then I love the idea that this slow process of film photography that you take with the film, you go to the same spot multiple times to get that one perfect shot, and then going to the dark room and then develop. It's such a slow process that we can't even think about it this time of digital era. But at the time, that slow process made it something very beautiful because you wait for the right timing. You don't waste the film. You wait and then you study the composition and then go back over again. And I love that process of slow process of film photography with my music making or my creation of project or concerts, because it's just such a slow process. I wish I can just whip one concert this month and another concert next month. It doesn't work like that for me. Each project takes tremendous amount of thinking and polishing and thinking again, is this right? And then get rid of piece and then see the flow and then talking and all of the other aspects. It takes years to make it one concert project to the public. I might be cooking for like 2 years, which is unthinkable for some musicians, but that's how I do it. And when I think of pairing black and white film photography, digitalized, because from the film to the projector, I felt home. Mm-hmm. That this is it. This is couldn't be more perfect, especially I'm pairing with a poetry that, again, you know, poetry is not like you write it one sentence and that's the perfect sentence. No, you edit it and never perfect. Mm-hmm. Poetry, never perfect. Classical music, never perfect. There's no point of completion. That master's mind of poetry and just try to succinct in such a way and match the mood of a certain piece. So the Shiem concert was all about this piece of music that I want to share, but around it I'm gonna have this army that support this art to elevate. It was not about poetry. It was not about black and white photography. But those two together to elevate the experience with music that I'm sharing. And I obviously, I wasn't sure how it's going to work. Is it going to distract people? Is this too much? Is it what? But then at the end, it couldn't be more perfect that how I shared. And then everybody was very surprised to experience in that way. And I had a struggles and challenges along the way, but at the end, I had to trust myself. I am a curator. Mm-hmm. I'm a bridge. So if I just let my sense, which I know this particular music I'm performing in terms of what emotions I want to convey or messages the most, then when I select the photography, when I select the poetry, it may not be the world's best photography, the world's best poetry, but that doesn't matter because I am the connector that curating this to experience it. That's still a worthy of it. And when I let go of what will be the best, you know, that then it was much easier process. You know, trust my sense, trust my belief in the certain particular music, and if I love it, maybe someone might love it too. But if I pretend to pair it such a way that because this is most well known, with the most well written or the renowned poetry or renowned photography, that would not mean much personally to me. But when I search one poetry that to speak to me really hard, out of 1,000 readings, mm-hmm. then that is it for me. That I found the jewel for me. And then when I share that in that enthusiasm and passion, I realize there's definitely one or two people moved by it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you write in your book, Jiyun, about how learners are happier because of, well, you express it well, I won't quote you, but, and I was thinking, Alan Brown, this photographer, I read a bit about him. It was interesting. He said he taught himself photography when he was in his 60s and really mm-hmm. pursued that. And then in his 70s, he learned ballroom dancing and then won some big award. And he's doing piano, like he's doing all these things as an older individual.
Yeah, the number, it's such a subjective thing. And, you know, in the past, when we think someone is 60, like as if your life is over, like now you're preparing just do nothing. But now 60, it's like, what? You just get started. And it's all in your mind. And the number games continues. If you have X, Y, and G followers, how many CDs did you sell? How many concerts did you have? How many audiences did you come to your concert? How many listeners in your podcast? It goes on and on and on. And we constantly put ourselves into the box of numbers, which is very toxic. Mm-hmm. And when I see someone like Alan, who's 90, still dancing, still taking piano lessons, and I remind myself, when I'm 70, when I'm 80, I want to keep learning something, whatever that is. I want to keep reading, expand my perspectives, and I want to be surrounded by who's learning too. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that effort, maybe small effort, makes everything, it's like I found just threshold through piano pedagogy education. I found the threshold with the learning, the joy of life, and process, the gift of process, and humbling process being a beginner again, and then the unlocking the creative mind that we all have just by trying out that I am beginner, because I am doing one thing like a piano for entire my life. I need to keep trying something new to balance out that I am, after all, human being, that I cannot do all well. And even as a pianist, that I have to accept the insufficient self, this, that humbling place that, you know, this is what I prepare for you. You may not like it, but I would like to share. And in that process, I've learned, I guess, one of the biggest lesson of life for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know you've I don't know if you're still surfing, but you studied surfing, and I know you're studying Spanish. I also try many different things as it fits. It's sometimes hard as a musician to go to like a regular class time, for example, but it's right. So important to try new things. Are there things right now you've started that are new for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, surfing is still a new thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you could relate, musicians spend a lot of time indoors, especially, you know, like violin, at least, I guess you could go outside, but you wouldn't. Piano, impossible. And when the pandemic hit, I realized my whole life I prepared to quarantine. Nothing changed, actually. I was just doing my thing, daily, you know, things that I want to do. And I was totally fine doing my thing in quarantine. And I realized, okay, that's good and bad. And I live in San Diego currently. And I realized, you know, I'm going to try surfing. That was after pandemic, but a couple years ago. Unlike the surfing experience that you see the videos and everything, and I actually took this surfing very seriously, as I would do everything else I do. I learned, I read so many books, watched a lot of video, I hired a professional coach, and, you know, I just give me how to practice, how to, you know, all of it. And then I went to the beach, and then there's no waves. There's no actual, and then like, come on, I'm ready to take a drilling. I need to do at least like 20 drills that I, you know, facilitate. And then there's no waves, nothing. And I was thinking, where can I drill? And then realized nature doesn't work like that. I'm like, really? And then I watched this professional surfer surfing, and like, so easy. They're just like walking on the longboard and go to the tip and, you know, just to turn, and like, oh, I think I can just visualize myself doing that. But then I go to the water, and even last 2 years I have like major injuries of foot injury, not fingers, thank God, but broken nose. And, you know, a lot of like major injuries that a lot of people was telling me, Jiyun, is this wise for you to continue this surfing? And then I had to do a deep soul searching. And what is wise thing to do? And then I realized, I could die on a sidewalk. Just do, you know, whatever the reason is. So I can't live life with a fear, but there is a things that I need to be more cautious. Wear protected gear. When it's big, don't go. Learn, you know, very safety, you know, things that I would do. And if I'm tired, I don't go out. You know, there's always accident happens when you're like neglective mode. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, I realized when I'm in out there in the water, I'm still such a beginner, and I can't. What was one of the most difficult things that I learned is that I hated accepting the fact that I'm just mediocre, so bad at surfing. I thought I would be so good at it. Unlike my hope, I'm not good at it. And what's so bad about it, Jiyun? You just have fun. And still not easy. But I get to the point that I'm sitting in the board, 5:30 in the morning, and sunrise in the ocean, and the pelicans flying and catching fish for the breakfast, and dolphins swim by and make those noise, whistle noise, and come and say hello, and all of it. And I realized, this is teaching me something that I need to learn. Through all these struggles of wanting to do well in surfing, and to this moment of, how amazing is it that I'm this outside of musical world, outside of my own box, out in the nature, this early morning. Then when I come back to the music, come back to the piano, I'm more whole. I'm more alive. I am more complete just because of all the mistakes and then be connected with nature. So that I did not know I would learn when I started surfing. I thought I'm going to just like really good at surfing and just become my hobby in sports. And no, none of it, my expectation wasn't true. My expectation was becoming, you know, good surfer and good active. And now realize that I'm learning let it go with surfing, importance of connecting with nature, and have fun and keep learning. Be a humble beginner all over again. Mm-hmm. And in the lineup, which is in the water, they don't know I'm pianist. They have no idea what I do. Doesn't matter what I do. You're become just a human being who loves surfing, perhaps. So my identity of pianist doesn't matter. And I like that. I think at the end of it, me within me, soul, it's not necessarily pianist. I may not play piano. Doesn't mean that I'm not who I am. So it's a very humbling experience that I'm learning through surfing.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I could certainly talk to you all day, but I'm mindful of our time. To close us out, I thought it would be really nice. I'm just going to look up his name. Yes, you lost a dear mentor, Reverend David Bremer, and I know that mm-hmm. he gave you a wonderful piece of advice mm-hmm. when you were at Indiana. If you'd speak to that.
Yeah. Well, actually, the other day I was talking to someone about David Bremer, and he was my mentor for a long time. You know, I came to United States when I was 21, and then I'm 43 now, so I'm actually tipping point to the more America than Korean. But at the same time, I don't feel American all the way, and at this point I don't feel Korean all the way either, so I don't know who I am. I am hybrid. I guess it is rightfully so. So when I came to America, I connect with him, and he was a pastor in an American, like, Presbyterian church. And from then on, I would just go to his office and just talk. And often, there were life challenges, and I would tell him. Because I did not have much of support system, like I don't have family here. And he was like a father figure for me. And then there's audition or competitions or the doctorate auditions that I was so struggling with. Every failure that I felt was huge. Like, I didn't get into that school. I failed the competition. I worked so hard. You don't even understand. I worked so hard. Why? And, you know, I also, you know, went through many, many difficult life, personal life, you know, divorce and all of it. Every time I ask, why? I don't deserve this. I worked so hard. If there's anyone who worked hard, it would be me. Anyone who wanted to make anything to work in relationship-wise, it's me. Why happens to me? Why? Why? You know? And every time when I bring those questions, I just want to know why. I is there any lesson that I need to learn here? You know? I was like complaining. And then he said, just very matter-of-fact tone. Although he's a very loving person, and he will say, don't ask why. Always ask what now. And like, and now go back to your practice room and practice. Like, oh. And then I thought about it over the years after his passing too. Whenever I feel why, then I hear now his voice. telling me, Jiyun, don't ask why. Just ask what now. And that simple life wisdom saved me so much misery of my life. And it is so true, because why is looking backwards in the past, mm-hmm. which I cannot change. What now? Ask being present and forward, and make an action of whatever you can do to move forward. And that by doing some action now, it propel your life in a positive direction. While I'm pondering something I cannot control, I live it in the past, which is also very dark and passive and depressing, actually. So every that lesson alone, I often ask, and I don't want to go to the why question, but inevitably, as a human, we do go there. Yes. But whenever I do that, I ask, what now? What can I do now? And then I get up again, smile, stand tall, and walk.
Beautifully expressed. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So thanks so much for joining me here today. Maybe we can have you back on the podcast later on.
I would love to.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.